The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
It is John Pollock, and oh, how I have missed that music for a special edition of the Post Daily News Show, because we are coming out of...
Music.
Yes, it is very, very nostalgic for me. Am I every day at 1 o'clock, that sound that would just go through my entire head as the world was spinning. But we had an impromptu earnings report this week, Brandon. Just like that, boom, we've got a earnings report to drop that they announced Monday afternoon. And we're going to go into all of the report that came out earlier today and the much anticipated call with all of the analysts. But what did you make, first of all, of just this very impromptu announcement Monday afternoon? I mean, we knew this report was coming, but I mean, I read it so fast, I'm just thinking to myself, oh, okay, we've got a week's notice. And then I'm realizing the date. Wait a minute. This is tomorrow morning at 8:30 in the morning, and they were dropping the documents. I think I saw them come into my inbox before 7.
Yeah, when they when I put on my tinfoil hat, I feel like they're tracking my location. They, when they made the announcement that there's an additional $5 million of unrecorded payments, I was driving. I pulled over, got off the throughway, pulled over into like a truck parking lot, and looked at the filing. And yesterday they dropped the 10Q, which is the long report, the most detailed quarterly report, the most detailed piece of information that they publish every quarter. And I was not expecting that at all. I figured, you know, it would be maybe posted around this time today. They're keeping me on my guard here. I guess I expected it to be Tuesday or Thursday. I mean, we mentioned that on Sunday on WrestleOmics Radio, that, you know, Tuesday and Thursday is usually the time that they want to do this. I think just for stock market timing reasons. And, you know, they were obviously late here. I expected, if this was a normal situation, for them to do their earnings call on August 4th. That obviously didn't happen, and they were trying to catch up on how they were going to deal with all the unrecorded expenses. So I guess there might have been other factors involved, but they wanted to get it done sooner than later, I guess.
How did you like the 8:30 a.m. Conference call? We've gone now from Thursday mornings at a reasonable during business hours time to Thursday nights at 5, and then boom, Tuesday morning at 8:30 a.m. Do you think this is a pattern of things to come, or do you think this was a convenient time where it was going to be very tough for people to be following this live and in the moment?
Yeah, I think most earnings calls for publicly traded companies are done just after the market closes. I figure they'll go back to what they were doing before. I did have to get up a little bit earlier than usual to handle this today. But
I know that Nick Khan was looking at the calendar and he's like, it's the first day of the G1 at Budokan Hall. And I know that this is going to cause a major problem for people. So let's do it right at 8:30 a.m.
But head to head with the G1.
That's it. It was actually a perfect lead in.
I like the rating for Raw. Yeah.
That's it. In terms of going into this call, obviously so much centering around Vince McMahon. Do you feel that going into this call that they believed that Vince McMahon would dominate the questions and the subject matter raised by analysts? Because I did think Vince would be a major topic of discussion, and it was really Vince McMahon.
About Vince on this call.
There were no questions about Vince. I mean, Stephanie did bring him up with pretty much, you know, in glowing tribute to Vince more than anything. But this was not something that was a pressing matter for the analysts about the investigation, about the unreported expenses. They were all looking to the future. And I think the executive staff, they were more than happy to field these types of questions rather than prodding at the investigation and all of that subject.
They're all looking forward to the next analyst dinner, maybe. There were, you know, I tweeted a list of questions, and questions about like, and I understand it's an analyst call. These are not journalists. but I would think there's an investor interest in asking a question along the lines of, you know, since June 15th, since this story began, or even since your investigation began, which was earlier than that, what have you done to ensure that talent and employees are not going to be subject to sexual harassment, considering you've got allegations surrounding a CEO and a head of talent relations? But nothing in the Q&A that even mentioned Vince. Brandon Ross from Lightshed asked a question. He seemed to be getting to whether or not WWE's going to sell. And there was a little bit of Vince discussion there. And Stephanie brought up that Vince McMahon is still very much the controlling shareholder. He still has eyes on what is best for our business in terms of maximizing our return to shareholders. But it was just, you know, what she said, other than her earlier glowing comments, there's a lot of vagueness, and I'm sure they prepared well for saying a lot of words, but not saying anything they don't want to say.
Yeah, the pleasantries for Vince McMahon were reserved for Stephanie McMahon, consistent with the on-screen farewell to Vince McMahon. There was the Stephanie McMahon segment on SmackDown, and that's what it was limited to. Nothing from Paul Levesque or Nick Khan, at least directly, about Vince McMahon. In terms of just the actual quarter itself, they reported a net income of $49.1 million and revenue of $328.1 million. Strong increases over the quarter of a year ago. Just take us into some of the overall analysis you took from the performance this quarter, which, of course, encompassed the two-night WrestleMania event, which did give things a pretty sizable boost.
Yeah, I mean, just financially, I do my estimates every quarter. This was pretty close to what I expected. But then again, this is, they gave preliminary results. So they gave away already an adjusted EBITDA, which is their favorite non-GAAP measure. And they gave away operating income a few weeks ago, when they, around the time, been so many 8Ks lately, it's hard for me to keep track of them in my head. But at some point, they gave preliminary financial results. So we got a pretty close idea to what to expect. A lot of money, as expected, a lot of guaranteed money, because now we have core content rights fees, that is Raw and SmackDown fees, that are guaranteed over time, that are fairly predictable. And in the network line, now that includes Peacock money, and the Q2 for Peacock is going to be pretty big every year, because it's not clear what the formula is exactly, but they get a lot of money in the quarter that contains WrestleMania, because I think they value different PLEs to different extents. We learned this. My favorite Q2 activity is to do the math and to look at the KPIs, the key performance indicators, turn to page 4 or whatever it is with the live events, and do the math, because they give you an average. Here's the average North American live attendance with WrestleMania and without it. And from there, I enter certain numbers into a spreadsheet, and it tells me, in this case, we got two nights of WrestleMania now, so I have to deal with that, but 55,000 paid tickets per night is basically what they implied. They don't say that directly. You got to do the math and pull it out of there. But 55,000 each night, about 109,000. And that's within a range of about give or take 5,000.
But wait a minute. They said 156,000. I watched WrestleMania both nights. It was 156,000 people there, Brandon.
Each night, 78,000 each night. WrestleTix counted the ticket map and got about 65, I believe, 1,000 each night. So yeah, I believe WrestleTix is pretty close to the tickets distributed, to the tickets that were out there. So that would imply like 10,000 comps around that, each night, something like that. That would get up to like 18,000 comps. So that's what's implied in the KPIs.
Yes, it was, so the average worked out to 6,800 per event for the quarter over 55 domestic events, but without WrestleMania, that goes down to 4,900 without WrestleMania. One area, and this has kind of been a focus for several quarters now, is their advertisements and sponsorships, which was one area that was down year over year. And this is with the return to touring, with, you know, a bigger WrestleMania this year than last year, where it was a limited capacity at Raymond James Stadium, and a question that Stephanie McMahon did field. And this was somewhat tied to that Business Insider article about, you know, their performance. And how did Stephanie take that question? And what were some of your conclusions from that specific area, which WWE has been compared to UFC, and it's, you know, been described as an underperforming section of the company?
Yeah, analysts are really focused on this. They have been for the last few quarters, at least. It's not something that would occur to me as being a big deal. And I even broke it out by quarter for the last several years earlier today and looked at it. And there is growth. I guess they expect more growth. And maybe if UFC is doing a lot better, then they should be, you know, trending in line with UFC. But I thought it was interesting that one of her comments was, I've got it written down here. We had a bit of a hold. We had a bit of a hold given the current situation, but a lot of positive momentum behind that. We are picking up once again. I don't know what the given situation, given the current situation is. Ongoing circumstances, I guess. I don't know if she was referring to the investigation. I guess I can't imagine what else she was referring to.
I have to think that that's where one would naturally conclude she was referring to.
And you contrast that with what appeared in the 10Q yesterday, where they updated a few risk factors in light of the Vince scandal. And one sentence that they added to the risk factors area of their 10Q is that, although we believe that no significant business has been lost to date, it is possible that a change in the perceptions of our business partners could occur as a result of the investigation. So I guess maybe it wasn't significant, maybe it wasn't material, but she's certainly alluding to something. Some sort of hold on interest that there was from advertisers, apparently.
Yeah, and this is where it was kind of wild for me, because sometimes we do have stories that, you know, maybe we are focused on day to day, but these are really not the topics that the analysts are going to get to the bottom of. But to me, like, the Vince McMahon investigation is just has all these different tentacles that go into its business. It's like the Netflix documentary was never brought up in this. A potential impact on your sponsors and advertisements. What is the status of this investigation? When are the findings going to be detrimental to this company? You know, all of this, I just think that there is a lot there that would certainly affect their viewpoint of the company. And the WWE, in not so like hidden language, is kind of stating like this is possible.
Yeah, I think I hear, you know, after a lot of like the AEW press conferences that they do, a lot of criticism of the wrestling media, that, you know, some of it is justified. And I think there's it reminds me of that sort of situation where you had a lot of analysts. No, they're not members of the media, they're not journalists, but they really could have asked some questions that are important to this business and important to, you know, what is going to change. And I think there's been a lack of understanding for years over what effect Vince was having on creative, just because people who are involved with making estimates about how this company is doing financially aren't that familiar with what the content really is and to what degree Vince is adding to it or taking away value to the company. But there's no communication that I know of, even internally, about, you know, what's happening in the workplace. Are there rules that have changed? How can people be assured that when they, you know, they talk to the head of talent relations or people working in talent relations, that you know, they're not going to be punished, or they're not going to be subject to sexual harassment? And I don't know, you know, when they write that the investigation is substantially complete, I mean, I guess we're not going to get much more information about it. Maybe there's not going to be a lot of transparency into what exactly this investigation concluded. Among other things that was going to investigate was the company culture, right? That's something that they've disclosed. So I don't know.
And, you know, what goes counter to that is, yeah, they've stated, you know, throughout the SEC filings, it is substantially complete is the terminology they're using for the investigation, and that $1.7 million has been spent on the investigation thus far, which Frank Riddick revealed in the call, Vince McMahon is going to pay for that $1.7 million. But despite being substantially complete, they expect to spend $10 million more, if not above that figure, over, you know, continuing this investigation on top of it. So that would, you know, suggest to me that there is still plenty to be done with this investigation if you're looking at an eight-figure spend on, you know, the expenses related to this investigation.
I guess they could be substantially complete now, and just that $10 million is going to happen in Q3, which is now, which those events could be in the past now, but just because we're in Q3, maybe that's something that's only going to appear mainly in Q3, and maybe not even into Q4, but we'll see. What did you make of Frank Riddick's comment that where he says Vince McMahon has agreed to pay the $1.7 million of expenses incurred to date and an additional but reasonable, I think he said reasonable, I had to listen to
yes, he said reasonable.
Reasonable expenses of the investigation not covered by insurance. So is he saying that Vince is going to pay for the investigation personally, even while we're in the midst of, you know, getting him out of the company and reissuing our financial statements after he spent personal money on things?
I had the exact same.
Had to be company expenses.
I absolutely had the same thought as you, that the way I interpreted it was that, yes, this is going to be a company investigation that Vince McMahon is going to spend his personal money towards, which is at the essence of what he is being investigated for. I was, yeah, that demanded some kind of follow-up or just a clearer explanation. But yeah, they explained
that. Who's paying for that additional estimated $10 million for the rest of the year? Is Vince paying for that too? It sounds like it.
It sounds like a portion of it, at least, he has agreed to pay for. Not the entire 10, but between insurance, Vince, and then, I don't know, does the company assume a certain amount? Like, this seems
These are questions for WWE. So is Vince McMahon going to pay for the investigation in which he is the subject of the investigation?
That I don't know how you could read it any more than Vince is contributing to this. I mean, he flat out said that Vince is personally paying for the $1.7 million that was just spent previously on the investigation.
Yeah. Did you get a chance yet to look at the amended 10K and the amended 10Q that they put out?
I've only skimmed through it.
It's not that big of a deal, I thought. It's basically WWE is $3 million less profitable last year because of this. But they're going to incur some costs in this year that they wouldn't have otherwise, I guess.
Going back to some of the just in terms of the actual earnings call itself. So we had Stephanie McMahon, Nick Khan, Paul Levesque, and Frank Riddick. And we mentioned Stephanie kind of addressing Vince right off the top and just pretty much giving a tribute to her father, who has retired and a succession plan was in place. And, you know, it was interesting that the certain terms that you just picked out here. She frequently referred to my partner, Nick Khan, like very much a united front here. And also, I felt like it was very strategic how they positioned the three of them as we have been influenced from WWE since we were young children. Like, certainly giving this, like, we are kind of the youthful brain trust that is now steering the ship of this company. But it was very much the three of them positioned as equals on this call. And then you had Frank Riddick as well, who was giving his presentation.
And Paul Levesque included in this call to an extent that he has spoken on these calls in the past, but it was in a situation where, like, Vince would just throw to him and he didn't even realize that he was in the room.
Yeah.
I imagine there's a lot of people in this room, but it's only ever made clear that there's like about five people in the room. But yeah, I thought it was interesting too in the question that Brandon Ross asked to her, because Brandon Ross had brought up her leave of absence, which she started in May, which lasted about 3 weeks or so, before she was made interim CEO and chairwoman. And I think, you know, Brandon Ross had used the word forced to come back or forced to return. And she made it clear in her response that she says, I was not forced into returning as a CEO and chairwoman. I offered. I think it just leads to further thoughts about like what really happened. Was it just because she wanted to spend time with her family? Were there other factors involved? I don't know that we'll ever know, but, you know, she's making it clear that she was interested in being the interim CEO and chairwoman.
Yeah, that was maybe the most interesting question that was asked, because Stephanie not only kind of addressed her leave of absence that, yeah, went about 3 weeks, and then she kind of couched that with, which is more than most people have. I mean, to have a leave of absence. So she got her 3 weeks and then back into a co-CEO position. And Paul Levesque, I mean, they didn't go over any of like his health issues over the past year, nor the fact that this guy is wearing, you know, two significant hats, not just as overseeing creative, but as well as head of talent relations here, beyond identifying him as such.
He was asked what fans and investors should look for in terms of the changes to creative. He said some sentences, but it didn't sound like anything other than some general, you know, rah-rah about producing good creative.
Yeah.
I guess it's just the context around the Stephanie comment is that, you know, she's a member of the board of directors, was, and now she's the chairwoman. Very possible that she could have been aware of the investigation, which had started in by April, So if she announces her leave of absence on May 19th, it's a good question to ask. Like, what did that have anything to do with why you left? But who knows if
we'll know. And she also, I mean, she could have just like ignored the implication about the question, like related to a potential sale, but she did, you know, address what Brandon was kind of, getting towards. And
did you read anything yay or nay from her response in terms of, is she okay with a sale or not?
I would say it was, I mean, certainly it felt like it is a prominent enough subject that she could have, answered that question without ever addressing it. She could have easily ignored it and just gone on to the next question. She made a choice to bring that up. And the fact that, you know, it was said several times that our mandate is to provide maximum value for our shareholders. So I found it to be maybe the most interesting answer, but I think also one that Stephanie, like, I don't think she just got tricked into talking about something that she didn't want to. I think it was interesting that she almost like volunteered that statement and put it out there.
And she alluded to reading between the lines of what was being asked. So she clearly knew it was about a sale. I read it as maybe she's not totally opposed to it. But I've talked to other people who read it the opposite way. So I don't know. So these things are like poetry. Everyone has their own interpretation of these things that are said.
Yeah, this is one of those calls where I felt like Nick Khan was more so one of the supporting players rather than the featured star of this call. Like he had his presentation and gave his state of the streaming and linear platform business. Extremely optimistic.
CEOs actually spoke. It's amazing.
That's right. That's right. The word count is now going to go through the roof for everybody across the board. No one is dragging it down. So. Yes, he did talk about some of the recent media rights deals that we have seen, Netflix bidding on F1 rights and the fact that he feels Netflix is only going to have a larger appetite for live content once they add their advertising supported tier. And, you know, it seems very consistent with the message he has brought forward that WWE is in a great position. And with the added, streamers that are looking for live content, they're going to have plenty of people knocking at their door.
Yeah. I've seen some discussion about, some skepticism of the notion that, you know, Raw and SmackDown really end up on a streaming platform and not on a traditional TV network. And, they may not. I would tend to think that at least most of the episodes of Raw and SmackDown in 2020, right, is the first full year. I would expect most, if not all of them, to be on traditional TV, or maybe there's eventually some sort of hybrid broadcast or maybe select episodes on streaming.
You've suggested NXT, and I could certainly see that being a fit somewhere.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the narrative that he's been pushing for could maybe probably over a year now, that there's tech players interested, you know, Amazon, Apple, Netflix. So those players don't necessarily have to acquire Raw or SmackDown rights for their participation in the bidding process to motivate Fox or NBC Universal to bid higher than they would otherwise. So like ultimately it's not necessarily about getting onto Netflix or getting onto Amazon Prime Video, but about enhancing the demand for WWE content and therefore enhancing the price and the benefit to WWE.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Did you expect anything more, just because it feels like these last, you know, ever since, you know, Netflix had their one quarter where there wasn't that growth. And now you add in like the Warner Brothers Discovery, their recent earnings call as well. Like this is certainly, I think, just cast some doubt on people about, you know, these streamers just having unlimited
Peacock
funds.
Flat.
Peacock without any growth over the last quarter as well. Like it's not just this endless supply of money for content, that, you know, at the beginning of the year, I think people looked at a lot of these streamers as having, and how that might affect some of these other bidding wars, not just exclusive to WWE.
Yeah, it's sort of emerging. It's going to be a more complex media ecosystem in the future, in terms of there might be that linear is going to have some sort of role in people's lives for a long time, and streaming will be a big part of it too. But I think there was, you know, in terms of the sort of the saturation of streaming engagement and consumption in general, I think there was a little bit of a sign of that in what they reported today, where they love to give us these delta, you know, these percentages year over year and difference between what WrestleMania did this year versus last year and every other PLE. So it's 60% for WrestleMania, was up by 60%. Backlash, this is in order, chronological order, right? 60% for WrestleMania, 49% for Backlash, 45% for Hell in a Cell, 20% for SummerSlam. Stephanie slipped in this Q3 SummerSlam number too. So those are all lower than the one before, down to just a 20% increase, which is still, it's good. It was more watched than last year. But I think we're getting, as we get nearer to the present, we get nearer to the time where Peacock has, at least for the moment, stopped growing, where they only have 13 million paid subscribers, 24 million or so monthly active accounts. So we're getting close probably to the time where, and by the way, I was trying to find it too. I couldn't find a Royal Rumble Delta. I couldn't find an Elimination Chamber Delta. I wonder if those are just less impressive. I doubt that they were like flat or negative, but maybe just less impressive. But I think we're getting into a time where streaming is, the explosive growth of streaming is definitely slowing down.
And unlike last year, we're not doing kind of the misleading comparisons of a Peacock pay-per-view, right, compared to a WWE Network pre-Peacock audience.
But like, Peacock last year, and you can look at the comments that Comcast executives have made to verify this, right? Peacock, maybe they didn't even start disclosing it. But anyway, Peacock last year definitely had fewer users, fewer subscribers than it does today.
Yeah, so this was pre-Olympics, pre-Super Bowl. Like, they had that big growth in the beginning of this year. So, Do you look at it from your perspective of is Peacock's lack of growth, does that make WWE more valuable to them, that this is one of our properties, that it is performing well, or this is not the game changer we were hoping it would be if you're looking at, say, a UFC and what its relationship to ESPN Plus has been?
I think in the context of everything that's happening on Peacock, they have to see WWE as one of the most important pieces of it. It seems like it did pretty well. It sure is benefiting WWE, I believe. The stabilization of their otherwise declining popularity in a lot of ways has flattened out, and I believe in large part because of just the larger audiences that those pay-per-views are able to reach on Peacock. But I think maybe, I guess it just depends on what Comcast ends up doing. Does NBC Universal end up getting merged together with some other media company and end up combining forces with some other streaming platform for Peacock? It just seems really uncertain, and more likely that there'll be some sort of complex outcome like a merger that changes it, as opposed to like Peacock deciding that they're going to spend less, which they're spending billions of dollars on content for Peacock. But if they decide that they're going to spend less, I guess that's probably not good for WWE, because it just means there's less money to go around. But unless they get acquired by NBC Universal, they don't necessarily have to stay on Peacock forever. There's other companies that might bid for that content too.
Were you surprised at all that nothing was addressed regarding this Netflix documentary that, I mean, Denise Salcedo has reported, like, it's off the books for Netflix. Like, I can't fathom that this thing is going to see the light of day, but it's just interesting because, you know, Nick Khan went out of his way to bring up in past calls, you know, how great this thing looks, and boy, wait till you see it. It's like this is a major project that they had undertaken, and not a peep from them.
Decided not to do it. You know, it actually became a really compelling story now.
They had their ending.
I mean, I'm not that surprised. You know, I write up my questions, and I don't realistically expect that many of them are going to get answered. But yeah. There was a little bit of discussion too about the Hulu rights, right? There was a question about whether, because those rights, which people in the US, they can watch Raw and SmackDown the next day on Hulu, that's supposed to expire, I believe, at the very end of this year.
Yeah.
I would think, you know, maybe by now there would be a deal announced, but there's not. And there's a question about whether or not they're just sort of holding off on that and considering rolling into the upcoming live US TV rights deal, which could be. Could be a, you know, you could definitely see them selling that to NBC Universal and those rights going to Peacock as part of a deal for Raw or something. But Nick Khan took that question and sounded open to it. But of course, they're open to just about everything. But that's conceivable, sure.
One other subject that came up a lot was this Clash at the Castle event that is coming up Labor Day weekend in Wales. And noting the fact that there was a subsidy involved in this that they are going to Wales for. It's not just like a big stadium show. Like this is enough that, you know, this is a Saturday overseas. So there's no SmackDown that they have on the calendar for that Friday. So, you know, it's a big undertaking for them, but also, you know, opening the idea of doing more of these where there may be places in the world that if they're willing to spend a certain amount of money, they will come and stage a live event for. And
are they taping SmackDown in advance that week then?
So the previous week they're in Detroit, and I haven't asked, but I would assume that's a double taping like they did right before Saudi Arabia, because on the schedule there's no SmackDown listed for that Friday, nor would that be feasible.
Right. You know, yeah, I mean they Frank Riddick mentioned Germany and France. You know, fans in Germany and France, I wouldn't get too excited about a major PLE happening in either of those countries, but they could probably run a pay-per-view in the UK every year for a while before they exhaust that market. So I don't know if that's what they should do, but just to give you an idea of the demand, they definitely could do something like that. And it's a question of, you know, why they took so long to, you know, to do an event like that. I mean, think just way back historically in 1992, SummerSlam, and how well that did at a time where business was definitely not hot. So, and
I think created so many fans for life in that market. Like that event just gets brought up by so many people that I hear from there. Like that was just such an important event. At a time when popularity was very low here, you went over there and it's a, you know, 30 years later, I think like that's the kind of event that it creates a lot of fans out of something that big.
It's probably this would really appeal to them. It's probably a lot of media that they could drive out of. Let's say do a show in Dublin, Ireland, or something, centered around, you know, Becky Lynch in a main event, maybe Finn Balor and something important, stuff like that, where they do have local stars in the country, not just in the UK, but maybe Ireland, maybe there's some other countries that they could go to where they have some local talent who ends up in a big match around it. And we saw how big there's like a big Conor McGregor fight in Ireland. Is that correct? Am I remembering that right?
They back in 2014, they did a fight night there with Conor McGregor. Right as he was that was after he had been injured for a year and came back, and it was the atmosphere was just unbelievable for this card, and they just loaded up the undercard with other Irish fighters, and it was, you know, I just think a tremendous event when it came to just, you know, showcasing Conor McGregor's popularity. And was really he did one more fight on television, and then it was just strictly pay-per-view after that. That was just a Fight Pass event when they ran that all those many years ago.
Yeah. And just you mentioned the subsidy. I mean, if they can get similar things, there was a question about whether this is David Karnofsky from JP Morgan asking whether maybe they can drum up some sort of bidding process for WrestleMania or maybe there's a, and Nick Khan did say that they're looking to replicate the subsidy that they got to do this event in Cardiff and in other cases with other major events. So, I mean, it just makes a lot of financial sense if you could get some help from the local government to encourage you to do this, not to mention drawing a big live gate and all the downstream effects that it may have that benefit you.
So they did mention the next large scale live event. And they did say Riyadh. They're giving out. So it looks like we are slowly moving out of large scale live event as like the coded mystery. And we've now assigned that same anonymity to another executive that was also let go. The mysterious John Laurinaitis, who will not be named in any of these SEC filings about in terms of fallout from this investigation.
Well, they got away a couple of quarters ago with saying, with Nick Khan referring to a third large-scale international event, which is in fact not a third Saudi Arabia event, but was the Cardiff show that they're now doing. But yeah, that's November 4th. Was that new news, or is that ever on any other?
November 5th. Yeah, that date had been out. Okay. Yeah, so that's a Saturday, and Yeah, presumably you would also like have a double taping again with like the Saturday international event, which they did do back in February, I remember, for Saudi Arabia, just doing a double taping the week before. And as I recall, like there was no hit on their viewership either. Like the having a show taped 7 days out, like doesn't seem to, you know, have any meaningful impact on the show either.
Right. So it's not like Fox is going to be upset about it. There could be some sort of agreement in their Fox agreement or their Raw agreement that X number of episodes have to be live. But I mean, we went through the pandemic with a lot of those events not being live, pretty sure.
So are you still looking at, you know, a similar timetable of in terms of the U.S. media rights deals of sometime next spring that you could expect an announcement, and that sort of being the ballpark here, where you would think like negotiations are probably ramping up. I am sure that Nikon has a very interesting call display.
Yeah, I would think May or June, that because you go back to what happened in 2018. I would have to look, but it's definitely May or June when they made their 3.6x increase on Raw and SmackDown. And if you go back to 2014, which was the round before that, that was, I'm pretty sure, in May, because you can tell. I think in both of those cases, if you just look at W stock, which, by the way, the stock I think is up a few percent today, probably just, I don't know, more sale speculation, or they did beat on earnings, but we kind of knew what they were going to do. Anyway, if you look at W stock graph over the last, I guess, if you just go to the all time, you can tell where there's this big drum up of on the share price, and then there's this big collapse because they got a disappointing deal. They got an increase still in 2014 of 1.7x, but this is the infamous Hammerlock comment.
That's right,
where Vince promised that they would at least double, and then he was hyping triple. Didn't happen. W Network, I think, got in the way big time there, because Comcast was probably not comfortable with this idea that you're undercutting our pay-per-view, and maybe you're going to cannibalize some of the engagement that we have on Raw and SmackDown. But anyway, so they got a disappointing deal then. Stock price kind of collapsed, and they got the 3.6x deal in 2018. So yeah, I would, you know, it could take longer, could take shorter, but that would put it, the target on, you know, late May, early June, somewhere around there.
As we wrap things up here, just because we haven't had a chance to have you on in a little bit, just, you know, with all of these changes to WWE, they're certainly riding a lot of momentum right now. From what you've been able to just see for yourself in terms of what impact this has had towards AEW and their own renewals that are going to be coming up, is it too early to detect, like, what kind of impact this is having on AEW and how they're looking at their next year as well, once they're getting into their significant negotiations as well? Like, where does AEW sit today versus a month ago with all of this news and the changes to WWE? And I would say definitely a more reinvigorated fan base for WWE's product.
Yeah, I think the ceiling on AEW is lower when you got Vince McMahon not in the head of creative job. Triple H may or may not be an amazing head of creative, but I think he's going to at least be better. Changes have not been massive and immediate, but I think changes will continue to happen over time. And, you know, Vince McMahon long ago burnt out his benefit of the doubt, but Paul Levesque still has some benefit of the doubt. And if I think about, you know, I haven't quite articulated it this way, but like, if you think about the way NXT became gradually better over time, it was sort of the excitement of watching NXT in the beginning, to me, was that it was overperforming. Like, almost, it was getting to be really good. It wasn't supposed to be this good, you know. There's some excitement in that, and it did move overnight from being an okay to good developmental brand to being like this, you know, WWE production value super indie. That was a gradual process. And maybe main roster WWE under, you know, Paul Levesque's head of creative leadership will be a gradual process too. Or maybe I'm just hoping that, because I would like WWE programming to be more enjoyable for me. But no, I think AEW is going to find themselves competing for talent more, especially in contrast to what it's been like over the last year or so since NXT 2.0 happened and since the NIL program got put in place. and since Paul Levesque was not in the in the NXT role and in the talent development role for about a year there, things seemed to change, and WWE seemed to withdraw from being interested in the same kind of talent that AEW was interested in. That's going to change. It probably has changed already. So there's going to be more competition for talent. And AEW's function as this strong alternative to WWE, that's less of a useful function if WWE is actually good, in the opinions of people who found it not good and needed AEW to replace it. In the big picture, that's sort of getting pretty far down the funnel in terms of how wrestling fans are going to feel. But in like the financial picture, I don't think now that like, oh wow, I don't know if AEW is going to get a good TV deal now. I don't think that this changes much of anything for that, because, you know, unless their ratings start to really sag, and Dynamite is still number one or number two, in the demo. I think that's, they're like 7 out of the last 8 weeks, number one in the demo among cable originals in 1849. So they're still doing pretty strong ratings. Now, Rampage has some real problems with its ratings. Did a decent rating last Friday. But Dynamite remains strong, in its rank. So as long as it does, I think it's going to be in a good position to get a good TV deal. Warner Brothers Discovery, strategy notwithstanding. But it doesn't necessarily have to be the case that AEW has to renew everything with WBD. So we'll see. I think, you know, I've said this a few times, but I think there's enough room for two companies of this size, in the wrestling space that have high visibility, that compete for the top level talent. And there was throughout the entirety of the '90s, and to an extent there was TNA in the you know, 2000s as well. But AEW, I think, is far past where TNA was. But, yeah, I think there's enough room for these two companies to exist, in terms of, it's not quite like a shoot sport where you have to have one super dominant league. It's kind of, in many ways, wrestling is kind of like, yes, it's sort of like a live sport, except it's a work. And it's also kind of like scripted entertainment. And obviously there's a multitude of genres of scripted entertainment out there. And there can definitely be two wrestling companies that present wrestling differently, that attracts different and some of the same fans, you know, who are looking to get different parts of their wrestling appetite served.
My last question, just, you know, being around like the wrestlers in kind of like your scene, when you're, you know, just the attitude you get from guys, how it's changed over the last few years, where you went through a period where WWE had just greatly expanded its idea of who could come there, and, you know, independent talent believing that I could very well make it in WWE. Over the last year, that probably narrowed, and now it seems like it's much more open in terms of, you know, the a talent who might have seen, okay, AEW is my pipeline to, you know, national television fame, and WWE now seems to be, I would be very optimistic as opposed to a couple months ago, in terms of like different avenues to make it to that level. Do you get that sense just at the independent level? Like, where is your funnel to, you know, a prominent spot in the U.S. scene?
I think with Vince gone, that, all of these abnormal, I guess, things that were normal, that really didn't have to be normal, those things don't have to be that way anymore. And I believe, you know, Triple H in about 2014 started to have a genuine change in his philosophy that I don't think has changed since then, in terms of embracing wrestlers with wrestling experience. And I think, like, wrestlers, you know, who are in AEW, for example, right now, they're going to, when their contracts are up, they will have another major company that, you know, can afford to pay them very well, and may not even just pay them well, but they may be signed to a company and actually be used in a way that creatively satisfies them. So it's a good thing for the very top wrestlers. This is a good thing that you've got two companies that are interested in the same talent and are willing to pay them well for it, and you might even be happy with your creative output. But yeah, it's changed a lot. You know, I remember in, you know, earlier on when I was training people, in like, let's say 2014 or 2015, I sort of, I remember telling somebody, you know, oh, you want to go to WWE? I don't know. You're in college, right? Sign up for, you know, okay, you play football. Great. Keep doing that. Try to be the best football player you can. And, maybe they'll sign you. But that was just before things started to change. And then, you know, it kind of went back for a year there in the last 12 months to being just be a college athlete again. But, you know, it appears that they're going to do both now.
Well, Brandon, the time always flies with you. I always enjoy doing these shows with you. I'm sure you are going to have plenty of coverage of the Q2 earnings report. What can people look out for over the next little while up at WrestleNomics?
Yeah, that's the news of the week so far. Whatever else happens, we'll cover on Sunday on WrestleNomics Radio, on your post-wrestling podcast feed, on the WrestleNomics Radio podcast feed, on the WrestleNomics YouTube channel. So many ways to consume WrestleNomics.
You guys are killing it. I think you are just, it's been incredible listening for you as long as I have. I just feel like you're elevating the game, Brandon.
I'm just trying to keep up with John Pollock, though.
John Pollock needs to sleep. This G1 earnings call combo, that I do not need to do again on my 4 hours of sleep. But that's going to wrap things up. So go check out WrestleNomics. It drops here on the Post Wrestling Network every Sunday with Chris Gullo and Jesse Collings as well, a great contributor as well to the WrestleNomics team.
He's been on frequently. I will negotiate with him about appearing again soon. Maybe this Sunday, we'll see.
There you go. It's the WrestleNomics next in line plan that is, you know, producing stars on a monthly basis.
Bad habits, but yes.
That is right. All right. We're going to wrap things up. Thanks to everybody for joining us and listening to our Q2 earnings analysis.